Are we on here? Are we on? Is this working? I can't tell. I talk a lot anyways. Okay, I'd like to welcome everybody to the August Trilogue meeting. Pizza has arrived early this time, so we're going to skip right to the fun. Can I please have a show of hands for people who are here for the first time? All right, for the first-timers here, please rise. You guys are first in line. Run, run, run. All right, now that everybody is fed and watered, welcome all again to the meeting. Something we like to do every month at the beginning of the meeting is a little have a job, need a job. So if anyone is looking for a job, this would be a good time. We'll give you a chance to stand up and tell a little bit about yourself and make your presence known to all the hiring folks who are out here. So if anyone is looking for work, let me see a hand. Got a couple?
Hank Montgomery, currently working for another 6 weeks. Contract's been in effect for 6 years at USPS. Going to run out in 6 weeks. They're not going to renew any of the contracts, I said. So I'm working in mainframe disaster recovery, planning, support, testing, all that kind of stuff. Background before 6 years ago was performance and tuning and storage management, also on a mainframe. Just now learning Linux.
All right. Anyone else? Rick?
Hi, I'm Rick DiNatale. I've been retired from IBM after 31 years for about a year now, and I'm looking to do a little consulting work to kind of keep myself out of the house a little bit more. I've been a programmer for 31 years. I'm particularly interested, well, anything having to do with open source stuff and whatnot, particularly interested right now in Ruby or Rails because my background is all in object-oriented dynamic languages. So I brought my CV if anybody's interested. So.
Okay, anyone else?
Hi, my name is Al Beam. I'm the misfit here. I'm a hardware engineer. I'm not really a programmer or a Linux guy yet, and I'm looking to potentially change. I'm doing hardware design for like 25 years, and potentially I'm looking for a change to do something else.
Okay, last call. All right, flip side of the coin. If anyone is hiring or knows of someone who is hiring.
RPath is hiring. We're looking for software engineers. Python skills are a plus, and web development skills are a plus. So resumes to jobs@rpath.com. Thank you.
All right. Anyone else other than Jason?
Is this thing? Oh my God.
A microphone on Jason is, you know, a little bit overkill, but anyway.
Yes. Bobwick is currently. How do you turn this thing down?
I had to bump the volume up so nobody on the phone could hear you.
Well, Bobwick is currently hiring a systems engineer. It's probably about 50-50 Linux and Windows desktop support. If you're interested in the position, feel free to come talk to me or David Roche after the meeting or send a resume to jobs@broadwick.com.
All right. Anyone else? Okay. If you have a phone or page or something like that, if you wouldn't mind putting that on silent or some other mode out of respect for our presenters, I'd appreciate that. If anyone has filled out a membership card previously but has not picked it up, at the end of the meeting, come on up here to the front corner, and we have an envelope full of those, and we'll get those out to you. If you'd like to fill out a membership card, we have blank ones up here. Get them filled out. Again, probably catch us towards the end of the meeting, and we'll get those to you at the next round. We're a little bit short-staffed getting data entered this evening, so we'll probably have to put that off until next time. But we do have the forms here. We are a nonprofit organization. If you'd like to donate a few dollars to the Pizza Fund. We have a donation box in the back. We are fortunate to have a sponsor this evening. Not only has Broadwick provided us with our presenters, but they are also sponsoring tonight's pizza. So let's give them a round of applause and thank them for that. And let me turn it over to John Biedesheimer and David Roche, who are going to say a few words, and then we'll move on to our feature presentation.
Hi, my name is Jonathan. I'm a fairly recent addition to Broadwick. I'm the director of their pre-sales team, which Jay said might make a lot of people in here kind of shiver. I just wanted to give a little bit of business context to you know, some of what Jay's going to be talking about and some of what David's going to be talking about. IntelliContact is the flagship product of Broadwick. Broadwick was came out with IntelliContact about 3 years ago. As of tomorrow, we're going to be releasing our 4.0 version. We're currently the number two provider of email marketing in the small business sector. We just passed about, well, we're creeping up on 5,300 customers, and we're, with this new user interface, we're seeing growth, you know, 30 to 50 a day. So it's an exciting time for us. The software is web-based. It's written in PHP, runs off MySQL and Linux servers. There's the tie. And it's designed for small businesses and nonprofit organizations to manage their remarketing campaigns. It has a fully functional contact manager, allows for additions of subscribers, you know, file imports, exports, sign-up forms, so all contacts can come into it. It's got creation tools, which it's got integrated creation tools to allow people to come in and create permission-based newsletters, sign up press releases, pretty much any message that you want. It's got all the sending functionality. The sending goes through our broadcast servers. We've got 13 broadcast servers, and post send reporting, so you can get full statistical analysis on pretty much everything having to do with the email, opens, clicks, forwards, that sort of thing. We are a permission-based service, so I know Jay mentioned a lot of people cringe at the thought of email when it comes to spam. We are we and many other providers like us are you know, permission only. We have extremely high policies and procedures, both for on you know on my side the pre-sales, but also post-sales for customers to maintain a you know a secure sending environment. We've got a no spam, no tolerance spam policy. There we go. And we've the application, David can talk a little bit more about this, has built in, you know, both automated and human review for any messages. We process 40, 50 million emails a month, so with a lot of traffic going out. Recent reports from independent an independent deliverability company showed that we had 100% deliverability to all the major ISPs. So deliverability is one of the areas that we focused on. And, you know, part of that is by maintaining very strict policies on sending. More recently, our version 4.0 is starting to represent a little bit of a shift in vision for the company. To date, we've been email marketing only now, and I'll let David talk about this a little bit more. We're trying to work in the idea that a single tool can be used to distribute e-marketing messages to multi-channels. So we've integrated feeds to RSS. We're adding or have added, David can tell you which one that is, public newsletter archives, publishing to blogs. We're looking to get into SMS. We're looking to get into, David will tell you what else we're looking to get into. The other thing that he will talk about that I'm personally very excited about because of my background is the availability of an API, which will open up a huge opportunity for us to integrate with e-business applications of any type. So I'm going to turn it over to David Roche. I wouldn't be a sales guy if I didn't say, we have a free 15-day trial. No strings, no, you know. But, no, you're welcome to go to IntelliContact, and we do have a trial if you have an interest in it. You know, Jay and David know how to get in touch with me. I've got WebEx on my desk. I mean, if you want to walk through it and explore it, by all means, let me know.
Thank you. Thanks, Jonathan. We spent a lot of time fighting spam, and I want to be very clear on that. I've been vetted by many people in this organization who introduce myself and tell them I work for an email marketing company, and they pull their hand back and refuse to shake it, and now develop friendships with a number of them. So if that is any testament to our dedication to eradicating spam and not sending any. Just to give you some numbers, of those 50 million emails that we send a month, we get a couple hundred spam complaints that we process automatically. They all get unsubscribed. And people who are sending to greater than 0.2%, people who have a complaint ratio greater than 0.2% get immediately dealt with by our deliverability department. But a little bit more about the application and about where it's going. It's gone from an interface with about 13 tabs to one with four, so that's now a lot easier to use. The main point I'd like for you to all to get out of this before I get out of your way and you can actually hear Jay talk about what you care about is that the software is very easy to use. It's great for small businesses. It really helps combined with whatever marketing you all are already doing, whether it be, you know, print advertising, whether it be nothing, whether it be word of mouth. It's great to stay in touch with your customers. It really helps you solidify relationships and generate future sales, et cetera. I mean, this works as well for nonprofits as it does for businesses. Jay himself runs a newsletter for his website. My wife rescues dachshunds and participates in an organization. She sends out a newsletter, and it's more than tenfold increased donations as a result of that. So it works on all sorts of facets, and I'd encourage you to see IntelliContact as something that you can get for $10 a month to prevent you from having to set up mail servers and call AOL twice a week trying to desperately talk to someone who knows the difference between a bounce and the reply button in your email client. That's pretty much all I want to talk about. If anybody has any questions about IntelliContact or scalable web apps or small business, please feel free to talk to me after. And then over to Jay. No? Not particularly. You don't need
to. Yeah, believe me, you don't want to have to call and fuss at AOL and stuff. That's not really fun. But all right, I'm Jason Faulkner, or most of y'all know me as Jay. That's Ian Kilgore. I am the systems manager for Broadwick Corporation. Ian is my minion, and by my minion, I mean he's the reason why I've survived 6 months at Broadwick without getting buried in work. He's a brilliant kid. Yay, Ian. Ian's great. And we're going to be presenting on Nagios. Okay, first of all, I'm going to preface this. There's been talk of holy wars between OpenNMS and Nagios. On slide number 29, I specify that me nor Ian know nothing about OpenNMS. So, no, why don't you do it like OpenNMS questions? Because I'll just look at you like I have no clue what you're talking about. So just preempt any of that. But Nagios is a network monitor for small to medium-sized networks. It's pretty flexible and featureful. You can have pluggable checks and notifications. It has support for host and service dependencies. Has a framework for escalation. A really nice web interface, and it does remote checks, and best of all, it's GPL. Hooray for free stuff. And now I'm going to just give you a sneak peek at the Nagios web interface, because that's one of the best ways to introduce it. And first of all, we're just going to take a look at one of your basic servers. I'm going to load up information on one of our servers here that would basically be what you'd consider one of your all-in-one Linux servers. It has a web server, a FTP server, mail server, MySQL, and you see basically we're monitoring all these services. And just to give you a quick overview, you see, you know, you can monitor lots of different things. About half of these checks are done from the remote monitoring host. Half of them are done from the actual server that's being monitored through a communication method called NRPE, which we'll get into later. And the nice thing is you do get a nice little summary of everything. You see we have 14 services here and lots of information on them. So it's a really good, nice, at-a-glance type of thing. And here's the big daddy. At Broadwick, we're using this. We have almost 250 services and almost 50 hosts programmed into here. So I'm going to show you a neat little thing to help describe how it's set up. Yeah, exactly. It's really nice. A little big, though. Basically, you have your monitoring host, which for us is this right here. And it connects up to all of your other hosts and does monitoring. And you do this by setting up kind of a hierarchy in your Nagios configuration file, which makes it nice because you get an at-a-glance view of what's up, what's down. If something's down, it'll be written in red text. It's really easy to see. Plus, this makes a pretty good little printout monitor of the network topography of your host. We use it for that. It's very helpful. But so that's a basic overview of the web interface. You can do lots of really neat stuff this way, like you can disable checks of a service. You can schedule a check. You can just disable notifications for a service. Like, you know, obviously you see we do have some services in red. It's just because the service monitor broke and we turned off the notifications for it until we could fix it. So if you do get a false alarm, it's easy to make it be quiet until you get a chance to fix it, which is very, very nice. And the web interface has a nice little bit of access control. If you don't want someone to be able to cut on and off your notifications or mess with any of the settings, you can just specify in your configuration files what users should have access to what. And it basically just forwards the Apache authentication. So if you've got just an Apache basic auth with an HT password file, you would just add the user to the HT password file and edit your CGI.cfg to give them permissions to certain things. I actually helped a guy set this up where he had a boss who wanted basically a status panel for all of their intranet services. And so he made a guest user that had read-only access to just the status. It's a nice little feature it has. Nagios 1.3 versus Nagios 2.0. Nagios 2.0 has some bug fixes. It doesn't do host group escalations anymore. It does passive host checks, and it has service groups. The reason I'm telling you this is because we run an almost entirely Debian Sarge shop at Broadwick. So in traditional Debian fashion, we're running Nagios 1.3. All of this information applies to Nagios 1.3. I can tell you that 99% of it is the same. I think a couple of the configuration variables may have changed. You can feel free to consult your local man page, but I'm pretty sure if you follow what we tell you here, you shouldn't have too many hiccups between the two different versions. And, of course, you can install it just with your distribution package. I know that Rails, CentOS, Fedora, Debian, Ubuntu, Gentoo have packages for it. And the only thing you need to run it is a web server for the web interface, obviously some type of Unix server. They have Nagios for lots of different, other than Linux, and then whatever your plugins are going to require, which can be basically anything. And so basically, whenever you install Nagios from a distribution package, you get their basic configuration, which segregates it off into your services and your hosts and your command definitions and stuff, and that's great for smaller setup. But, of course, we have 50 servers and 250 services. With each service definition line taking up about 10 lines of code, you can imagine how long our service configuration file would have been. We're looking at over 1,000 lines. So we've had to come up with a better way. But it's a company trade secret, and I'm not allowed to share it. Or am I? Ha ha! The super secret Broadwick Nagios configuration. I thought it was weak, guys. Come on. Maybe I should have got the sales guy up here to hype that for me a little bit more. But we separate our configuration files into two basic groups. We put our host and our service definitions grouped together by host in a configuration file for each host. We stick that in its own directory and use the configuration directive of Nagios just to say, read everything in this directory. Everything else we just throw in a conf.d. This helps simplify it a whole lot. It does a couple of really nice things, such as if you have a web server, you build another web server, and you need to set up monitoring for it. Instead of having to write a configuration file from scratch, you can just copy your old web server's configuration file over, do a search and replace on it, and you're now monitoring your new host. And so that makes it really nice. It makes it a lot more maintainable, especially in environments where you're going to have similar machines. And I say that templates are very good to use in Nagios, mainly because there is a ridiculously large number of individual options for each service. Nagios picks some pretty good defaults, but, you know, like check interval, notification groups, parents, which is what you saw with the service map where we had the network parents set up for each host. I say you need to use the templates to avoid duplication. It takes a little bit more work at the beginning, but it's worth it in the end. So now we're going to go over a basic configuration example. everything, every file, every script, every configuration setup I'm talking about here is up on trilog.oldos.org. You can go there now and see it and follow along if you like. But basically, we've made an example Nagios config, and we've tarred it up for you so that you can see the way we do things. But we're going to go with the example of you have a web server host, and you want to monitor that web server. So the first thing you have to do is you have to set up a host template. And in that, you're going to basically define a few things. You're going to call the template something. We're going to call this critical host because, obviously, our web server is important. Now, you can have as many templates as you want. You can have a critical host, a regular host. You can have a web server template, a DB server template. The number is really unlimited, but we're going to call it critical host. We're telling it to notify us if something goes down. The register zero is just telling Nagios that it's a template, that not to register it as a real host. We have the check command is check host alive, which is basically just a ping to the host. And max check attempts. What that means is it means that Nagios will not page you the first time something fails. That means that it has to fail 5 times in a row for it to page you, which is pretty nice if you've got unstable network conditions, things like that. We have it set to notify us every 60 minutes, and we're telling us to notify it whenever the service goes down and whenever it recovers. The only other option you can add there is unavailable for a host, which is if the network connection is unavailable to that host, which is the reason we don't want it to notify us if say, the router's down or something of that nature. And now you have to create your host definition. Now, saying that the host name of the server is just web server, you would create the file host/webserver.config, or, you know, in our specific configuration, it's /etc/nagios/host/templates.cfg. And you're telling it to use the critical host template, and then you're just defining the web server, defining a pretty name for it, and you're just giving it an address. In our setup, we use all IP addresses. It makes the notifications not as pretty, but it also makes Nagios still work if your DNS goes down. But that's up to you. And then you need to create a service template. Again, we're putting this in the same file as we put our host template for simplification. And most of these are the same. We're just telling it to check the service every 5 minutes, that the service has to fail 4 times in a row, before it'll page us, that it's going to retry checking that every minute, that if the service goes down, it's going to contact the sysadmin contact groups, which is defined in a separate configuration file, which we'll go over a little bit later. And it's going to notify us every 60 minutes, and the notification period is 24/7. Now, that's something that's really nice, because say you have some intranet services that you don't want it to wake you up at 3 a.m. in the morning if your intranet goes out, because obviously you can fix that at 6 a.m. instead of 3 a.m. So you can set up a notification period to say, just notify me during waking hours or during working hours or any type of setup you want. And then we're telling it to notify us if it's warning, critical, and when it recovers. The only other option you could put there is unknown, which would basically be if you had a misconfigured plugin of some kind. And again, the register zero just to tell Nagios that it's not a real service, it's just a template. And then you have to give it a command definition. Now, keep in mind that, you know, you'll have a basic host template, service template, and, you know, most of your command definitions already done with your distro package. So some of this you won't have to worry about, but we just won't get everything covered. But basically, you just define a command, and the command name check HTTP, which is what you'll refer to it everywhere else in the Nagios software, and then you just run a command line. One really nice thing about Nagios is that you can run that plugin from the command line just like it's a regular script and see what it returns. So it's a really good way to test your plugins before they actually go into production. Like if I were to go on to our Nagios server right now and run, you know, check HTTP-H, and then put in a web server, that would then give us a return code of okay or warning or critical and return the exit code along with that, which is what Nagios will read and we'll get into later. And then finally, the important thing, the actual service configuration. Again, looks very similar to the host configuration. You're just telling it to use your template, what the host name of the box is, and by host name, it's whatever you called it in the host definition. It doesn't matter what the actual host name of the box is. If you defined it as host name of Billy Bob, then you're going to have to refer to it as Billy Bob in the rest of the Nagio software. You're just giving it a service description, which is something you can use to track the service. And you're just telling it the check command, which we defined earlier as check HTTP. But, you know, there's some things you have to check remotely. Like if you want to check load on a server, if you want to check disk space, swap availability, you can't do that from a remote location. So you have to set up your Nagio server to do remote checks, to reach out and to do that check on the box. The three different ways we found to do this. You can use check by SSH, which requires you to deploy SSH keys, and it kind of leaves you open to attack a little bit because you're running these arbitrary Nagios plugins over an SSH connection, and you're going to have to deploy most likely root SSH keys to all of your servers to the Nagios user, which I certainly wouldn't want to do. I don't recommend it, and we officially dub it a bad idea. There's something called StatD that Google has conjured up. Don't know what it is. Never used it. Couldn't find any good information on it. And then there's the good thing, which is NRP. Stands for Nagios Remote... What is it?
Plugin Executor.
Yeah. Nagios Remote Plugin Executor. Yes, hold him. What's bad about what? The security problem with SSH keys is simply the fact that you have to deploy SSH keys, and plus the fact of if you get a plugin compromised on the box, you could sometimes run some type of arbitrary command. Like if there was a bug in your Nagios plugin, you could escalate privileges and do lots of bad things. The Nagios developers have a huge, big paragraph on why you shouldn't use check by SSH, and if you care to know that much, you can look it up. But it's generally a bad idea. NRP, how it works. The Nagios server basically just reaches out and talks to the NRP daemon on the monitored host, and it gives it a command. Those commands are mapped to plugins in the configuration, very similar to the same way you define commands for the main Nagios server. NRP is also secure because all NRP transmissions use SSL, and you're required to specify the hosts that are allowed to connect. It uses an IP address-based blocking. Only the IP addresses you whitelist are allowed to connect to the NRPE daemon. The only caveat is you do not enable arguments. Those can be substituted into the command line, and it's bad for a lot of the same reasons check by SSH is bad. Again, I leave it to your own imagination to think about the privilege escalations and things that could come from that, but the Nagios developers also scream and yell at you not to enable that setting, and I agree. Does someone have a hand up? What do you mean by host keys? I have not seen that in practice. We were looking at it, and the only thing I was able to see is an allowed host setting. To be honest, NRP pretty well worked out of the box for me. So I didn't investigate too much onto the deeper type of securities to it. We actually are doing our checks over a VPN and only allowing connections from internal IPs. So we have that added layer of security over the top of it. I believe that added host is the allowed host is the only way to specify the security. Not 100% sure. In a perfect world, I would suggest just enabling NRP over a LAN or a VPN, just so that anyone from the internet can't negotiate that connection. In a basic NRP setup, you just there's NRP packages for most major distributions. You would install it and edit your NRP.config, or I know on Debian they create an NRP_local.config you would edit. You just add in your allowed host with the IP of your Nagios server. Then you just simply define a command. And you see the difference is on this one than the Nagios one is that you don't have any macros defined. You have to specify everything on the command line. And that, again, is why you don't enable the arguments, so that people just can't add stuff to the end of your command line. And, you know, there's lots of different plugins. Basically, any plugin you can use on a Nagios server, you can use on an NRPE server, which is really nice. And then on Nagios, you would just specify, you know, you've got a critical service for the web server of users, then you just call check NRP, and then the command after an exclamation point. And so in this case, we've got check users set up to give us a warning if 5 users are logged in and a critical if 10 users are logged in. And, of course, that's arbitrary numbers. You could use any plugin you wanted, and the syntax would be similar. You know, another nice thing about the fact you can execute the Nigerist commands from the command line is most of them will have an inline usage. If you're trying to figure out different ways to use a plugin, you can call it from the command line, usually with a help parameter or with bad arguments, and it'll give you a usage flag, just like most other programs will. And it's pretty nice for finding out maybe some undocumented features. Now, there are some more advanced Nagios configuration stuff, like dependencies, escalations, custom plugins, you know. Getting paged 100 times if the network goes out, it sucks. I've had it happen. I know so much about Nagios because I stopped liking to get hundreds of pages and bad things happening when my network went out. Escalations. Because we don't always wake up when our pager goes off. Not when I page someone else. And custom plugins because all of us have some special needs. And now Ian's going to take over and tell you a little bit about some of the scripts we've written to dynamically generate service dependencies and escalations. Again, these are up on trilog.ordos.org if you want to see the code yourself. Everything we're talking about tonight, that is code, is licensed LGPL. So you can feel free to take it, use it, modify it.
All right, we wrote a, can you hear me? We got a couple scripts here to automatically fill out these service and escalation setups because you have to define them for each host or each service that you want to, that you want something to depend on or you want to escalate. So that sucks because we have like 250 services. So we want a script to do that. The service dependency script just acts as a filter. You cat in all your host and service definitions. It'll parse it and then output service dependency definitions. So what happens when you do this is, say you have the host web server. All the services on web server will depend on the ping service for web server. And also, if web server has a parent host, like router, all the services in web server will depend on ping for router.
Actually, the way your script's written, it doesn't use the parent host. You have to manually configure your host
dependencies. That's right. Yep. We have host dependencies. So if you set up your host dependencies to make web server depend on router, then all those web server services will depend on ping for router. And so that way, if router goes down, and web server has like 20 services, you don't get paged 20 times. You get paged once for router, which is good. So the usage is right here. Like I said, we just cat everything through the script, and then it creates this file here.
Again, this is another benefit to using the configuration dir that makes stuff like this a little bit easier.
The escalation script is similar. It also acts as a filter. You just cat in all your services, and it will create a little, it's got a template inside the script for the escalation definition, and it'll just plug in the service names. And so, for example, if you, Jay here gets paged like 5 times and he doesn't answer.
That never happens.
Yeah. It'll escalate to someone else for every service. Custom Nagios plugins, really, really simple. We have like 5 plugins. They're just like 10-line bash scripts.
Right-click, yeah.
Yeah. All right, and the Nagios server will read 2 things from your plugin script. The first is an exit code, which are listed here. 1-0 is okay. 1's warning, 2's critical. Anything else is unknown. And it'll also read a short line of output so that when you look, for example, at the web interface, you can see what's going on. Like if it's disk, how much disk is actually being used up, if it's load, what the load average actually is, that kind of stuff.
Most of the time that's included in your notification as well, so if something weird were to happen and you were to have a connection refused or something, that's returned just as if there was status information to actually add. We didn't cover a couple of things. We didn't cover passive checks. Nagios will accept passive checks. The general idea is that you could set up some type of plugin or cron job to submit its results to Nagios, and Nagios would page you if those results were out of whack or if it didn't receive the results. There's also distributed monitoring, which basically makes multiple Nagios servers talk to each other. We don't do either of these. They're a little bit complex, but there's really, really great docs on the Nagios website. Yes?
I've actually tried setting up the passive
point where it accepts the new data, but the freshness checking that you were talking about, where if it doesn't receive any data, was not working. It would just, instead of every 15 minutes timing out, it would just happily sit there for days saying, oh, yeah, you're fine.
Yeah, I think I saw a bug fix for that. Whenever we were scanning through the 1.3 to 2.0 changelog, a lot of that stuff relating to passive service checks was revamped, and it's done a lot better now.
I was trying it on 2.0.
You were? Oh, well, I don't know. Maybe they didn't do...
I don't know if I missed some little nuggets of documentation or if it's still hardly broken.
Yeah, Nagios can be a little bit finicky at times. Yeah, I left that slide out.
Can I bring it back?
Yeah. Yeah. That's fine. We are using the parenting. It works about as well as the freshness checking does, apparently. That's where you see that status map that we brought up earlier. We do have parenting properly set up for services to be marked as unreachable and things of that nature. We spent days trying to successfully get parenting to work. We were unable to. I don't know exactly. We do have some strange needs where our network congestion would become very high and services would periodically go in and out type of scenario. So maybe the host check will return up, and then maybe the ping service will return failed or something of that nature. So, yeah, so we found that the service dependencies are significantly more reliable, but I would recommend setting up both. Because the parenting does give you the nice graph. It gives you the better network topography vision of how everything works. In fact, we're using nested templating to set up parents for all of our hosts because we have three different locations. And we just nest in the template and put in the parent command in the template. So we would just call in a host definition that, you know, it would be a hosted solutions host or a Peak 10 host as our template. And it would pull in all of those settings for us. Anybody else? Yes. It does work in 2. Were you using 2.0 or 1.3? Oh.
I'm moving up to 2.0 right now.
Yeah.
Good to hear that.
Yeah, we had sporadic success with it. We just decided that the service dependencies work a whole lot better for us, and with the script to dynamically generate it. You know, something we do was we just wrote a shell script to automatically update those the service dependencies in the escalation. So if we added a host or service, we would just rerun that script and it updates everything for us. And I've not had any problem at all out of the service dependencies checking. There are a few alternatives to Nagios. There's OpenNMS, which I believe is written in Java. There's Big Brother, which is written in Bash. Angry customers calling your support department usually ends up written in Blood. And you can hire a bunch of interns with cell phones and a terminal, and that one idea was written in India. Oh, Sanskrit, yeah.
One of my
That's pretty good. I've noticed for anyone who has hosted solutions as your data center provider, they seem to have hacked up an Nagios web interface for their dashboard as well, which seems to be kind of nice.
Last time I checked, the Big Brother's not free of freedom.
To be honest, I haven't used it. I'm ignorant of the other two simply because I have blinders on my eyes and Nagios was in place when I got there, and so that's what I used. I haven't researched many of the alternatives very much.
You go to their website, they have a better than free license, which basically you make your money on your internet connection, which a lot of people do, you have to pay
the money. Not very free. That seems like it'd be pretty good at, you know, letting you know when stuff's broken. We're going to show them let me show them the custom plugin and then you can go to the other stuff. All right, now we're actually going to show you now, the slideshow's over, but we aren't going to shut up yet. You can't get rid of us that easily. we're going to go over a few things. Our script, we're going to go over the two scripts we discussed. We're going to basically walk you through Arnagio's configuration so you can see some of the things that we didn't cover in a presentation, because obviously if you touch on every configuration variable in the world, we'll be here until 10. So basically here is a Nagios plugin we wrote to monitor a process. There's actually a plugin that ships with Nagios that does this same thing. It does have limits to, it'll only allow you to check on, processes that are shorter than a certain character length. And we have some processes that are about 30 characters long we have to monitor. And so all this script does is it just, makes sure that your process, the process name, is running. And you see, all we had to do was define a message to spit out when it was okay, when it was critical, when it was warning. And we just basically issued a command, and we're checking the output of it just like you would in any other bash script. And we just spit out the exit code. And just, you know, these few lines are enough for an Nagios plugin, and we have it running on probably over 20 servers, and it's even better than the one written in C that Nagios ships. Did you break my screen?
You broke your screen.
What did you do to my screen, man?
No one made your screen. Power detach. I don't have wireless there. Screen-RD. Capital RD.
Ah, there we go. All right. Hey, it's back. All right, we do have a couple other plugins. One of the coolest ones, this one Ian wrote, actually checks to see if a route exists. It basically, you just call it with a network without the /24, without the subnet, just the actual network octets. And this will actually spit out, and it'll check to see if it's found a gateway. If it finds the gateway, it'll ping the gateway. And what happens is it gives a critical if it finds no gateway, a warning if it finds a gateway and you can't ping the gateway, and an okay if everything's okay. That's a pretty neat little thing. Just an example of, you know, maybe a custom need that we had that we addressed with an Nagios plugin that we weren't able to find anywhere else. And then there's also another one that's really simple that Ian wrote that is just a PHP Nagios plugin that just basically checks to see if a PHP function exists. So if you have a specific PHP function that your software relies on and you have people with root who you don't trust, you can check to make sure that they didn't delete a PHP function. It's pretty nice.
The reason why this was written actually is because when a server got upgraded, this PHP extension just got wiped out, and so we wanted to make sure that didn't happen again, because we only found out about it a couple days later.
Oh, not on my server. Just kidding. And just to give you an idea of some of the plugins that ship with Nagios, to give you an idea of some of the different things you can do. You can, you know, check to see if a DHCP server is working. You can check to see if an IMAP server is working. We actually have a couple of plugins that'll check to see if MySQL replication is working and current. We have one that checks NODB free space on MySQL. You know, just a ton of different things that ship with Nagios, and also that, you know, you can create your own or go to nagiosexchange.org and download some. And you know what? We didn't even talk about our RSS notifications. Yeah. We actually hacked up a plugin that we got off of Nagios Exchange that when we got it off of Nagios Exchange, it didn't work, so we fixed it. And it actually will spit out our Nagios results to a RSS feed, which is very, very nice. And in fact, I'll make this available. It's not up right now, mainly because
we forgot about it. But we wrote this plugin and we hacked it up where it'll create an HTML file every time a service goes down, just like it would page you, and it also creates an RSS feed. But you can see it stays up to date. So instead of email notifications, a lot of people have moved over for us to the Nagios RSS feed, which we found to be really nice. And now Ian's going to go over the scripts he wrote. Does anyone have any questions at this point? Any? Yes. Yes. That's usually done by the RSS feed reader. You know, obviously, for someone like me who's responsible for all that to work, I have a pager, and I also chose to keep the email notifications. What the RSS feed is good for is if maybe you had a support team or maybe some developers which were wondering why something didn't work, they can go and check the RSS feed to see if anything bad has happened. Or, you know, maybe another scenario like we were talking about earlier with the additional users of you maybe have a boss that wants to be notified when something went down and when it came back up. It's just another way for to keep users up to date on what's going on. Any other questions? Yes. Bye. Actually, we haven't. We use Ganglia for a lot of that type of monitoring where, you know, we want to keep statistics on load and disk space and stuff like that. So we've never implemented SNMP. I've found it generally easier just to use the NRPE plugins that exist or to, you know, hack one up real quick in Bash. Will SNMP do things like pull the process lists and stuff like that? That's pretty neat. I have to check that out. Yeah. What do you mean by that? Like, it's SSL, but I haven't. Oh, Nagios, the NRP plugin just basically sends back that one line and an identifier of the exit code. It's nothing fancy at all. It's a really simple, and that's probably part of what helped it work so well for us. Anyone else have a question or something that we haven't discussed that you maybe want us to hit on before we get a little bit more into the script? What do you mean by that?
How much of it? Is it all straight out of Nagios?
What we did was you can set up notification plugins, and check commands for the notifications are handled a lot the same way the checks. You know, we set up the check HTTP. We have a notify by RSS command that basically spits out the macros to a shell script, which then does some parsing to it, creates that HTML file, and then passes it on to a Perl script, which actually mangles the RSS up for us. And I don't have those ready because, honestly, I've forgotten we were using that. It's working that well. It never breaks. I don't ever have to mess with it. So I'll package those up, and I'll throw them up because that was a GPL plugin off an Agios Exchange that we just modified. And so it'll probably be up there either tonight or tomorrow in the back. We are using Nagios with NRPE plugins to monitor tests. You want to bring up the web interface and show them some of that?
Sure.
You see, one of the things that we have found actually very, very helpful is a swap monitoring,
where we check for percentage of swap that's being used. That's something we found extremely helpful for catching a box before you know, maybe a bad process runs away with it or someone executes a script in such a way that it starts leaking memory. It'll catch it and buzz us and say, you know, 50% of your swap's in use, and then we can go remedy the situation. We also have done monitoring with load. We do some monitoring with disk space. What's some other things we monitor, Ian?
Got the ganglion monitor, FTP, although that's not a NRP.
No, it does not do charting. This is simply a notification service where you can set thresholds for warning you're critical, and it'll page you and say it's broken. It does have some charts that'll basically tell you how long something was up or down or in warning state. We don't use them, and they aren't that pretty. We use Ganglia for most stuff like that.
Oh, nice.
That's pretty cool. Like I said before, we mainly use this. We have enough servers that, you know, yeah. I've never had a problem with Nagios not paging me when something went down. It's paged me lots of times when stuff didn't go down. But all right, so. Is there any other questions or anyone have anything that maybe we went over a little bit too quick you want us to go back and give a little more detail on or anything like that? All right, so let's jump into Ian's first going to go through our Nagios configurations so that you can see basically the way we use it and kind of demonstrate for you the 3,000-line configuration files and why we script the creation of those. So.
All right, main Nagios configuration file is nagios.cfg. And this basically all it does is define a bunch of other places to look and very general things. You see we've commented out a lot of these because we have our new super secret Broadwick method. So these CFG DIRs right here, we have host and conf.d, and as we said, host is where all our host files go. Conf.d is everything else, templates, notification commands, check commands, that kind of stuff.
Basically with the exception of your resource.config and cgi.config because
right. Those don't like being moved.
Yes.
cgi.cfg is for the web interface. Nagios daemon doesn't look here. This is where you define access controls, users, stuff like that. Where's the access control in there? Use authentication. And see, stuff like this, authorize for system information, authorize for configuration information. There's a whole bunch of these, and so you can really tune it. It's our NRP setup. I don't think we have NRP setup here, as this is a central monitor daemon.
The NRP.config on that box is actually just stock Debian. All of our custom stuff's in the local file.
Yeah. It actually used to be remote host, so these are our NRP commands. It's our giant long list of allowed IPs. So as you can see, we just, you know, each command is just one shell command, a couple arguments given to it, certain thresholds.
Like we were talking about before, you can enable arguments on the where the Nagios server can send those arguments, but there's a huge stanza in the configuration line lecturing you about why you shouldn't do it, and I tend to agree with most of the points they make.
The config directive to enable arguments is actually called "Don't blame NRP."
The idea is basically enabling arguments, you're allowing fast to go on the command line.
Right. They're substituted right in.
They actually do have NRPE for Windows as well, don't they?
So this is the conf.d. This is where we stick all the miscellaneous stuff that just needs to be done once. These are the check commands. This is where we define things.
These are actually more of the custom check commands that you set up whenever you install special plugins or stuff like that. All the other check commands and the notification commands are in miss commands.
These are all the plugins. I think this is the constructor format. They switched in some version number from a flat file to this. I don't actually think these are being used here. All right, here we're defining contact groups, which will you reference in the host and service definitions. We have a sysadmin contact group, which is J, RSS, and then this. And then we define the actual contacts right down here. This is a template. This is not a template.
Yeah,
templates are in templates. All right, so here we're defining individual people, methods of contacting them. There's the contact commands or notification commands are also plugins. So you can theoretically do whatever you want with that.
Yeah, another nice thing is you can also, just like you can set up the services not to notify you all the time, like with the time period directives, you can also set that for certain contacts. So if you had people on maybe three different shifts of sysadmins working, you could set it where those people were in a group together and where they would each only get paged when they were on duty.
All right, this is the dependencies config file, which is created by that service dependency script.
And that's the host steps file, bro.
These are the host steps. This is what the service dependency script uses to create the service dependencies. We define a host. And then this children host, what depends on it.
The notification failure criteria is just basically saying if the host is down or unavailable, then don't notify us about anything about the dependent host.
And this is the serve steps file, which is created from that with that script. And it's much the same, but with services. And this is why we script it.
How many lines is that thing up to now?
It's a whole lot. 1,800 lines. So
the escalations, I think, is even worse.
Yeah, that's a lot of lines. Escalations config, basically saying for this host and this service.
Something that's interesting to note, whenever you escalate, if you don't specify, like say you have... you have Bob, who gets paged five times and doesn't answer his pager, and then you escalate to Joe. If in the escalation definition you don't include both people, only the second person gets paged after it escalates. Yes? Oh, we didn't point that out in the web interface, did we? In the web interface, you can acknowledge that a service has been down. Why don't we go ahead and acknowledge the admin one?
This is warning. Acknowledged right here.
Yes.
Okay.
No, we didn't cover downtime. Yeah, that is a pretty cool thing. Everyone at our company who has notifications of Nagios know how much I tend to neglect downtime whenever I'm fixing something. But
he's the one that gets paid, though. He kills himself.
basically, in Nagios, you can set a services down. So if you're going to be working on it, like say you're going to be purposely taking it down for kernel upgrade or something, you can set service downtime for, you know, say between 1 a.m. and 2 a.m., you can set it down. Nice thing it does do is it does like a soft downtime. So that you can set it for soft downtime around 1 o'clock and lasting about 3 hours, and it'll automatically detect the first time it goes down and start that clock then. And then whenever it comes back up, it'll stop the clock.
Now an ad for Nagios 2, downtime has one fatal flaw in one, which is unless you've done some dependency magic like what they're doing, and frankly, unless you got as much as you guys have, that's a lot of practice. unless you said when you schedule downtime for a host, it does not schedule downtime for the services on that host.
That.
So,
oh, that's nice.
Yes,
that's very nice.
Have triggered downtime, then trigger when that router goes down, their downtime starts. Very cool stuff.
That is very nice. That was actually part of the reason why I tend to ignore downtime because, you know, if we're taking out a VPN server or something, there's absolutely no use in setting downtime because I'd almost rather get the service go critical and let the dependencies kick in sometimes.
Know something can go down. In the case of NT, you have to reboot your servers every night, so you know what's going to happen.
Well, if you know exactly when it's going to happen, set your time series to not include that time.
So what time series?
The time series definition. They didn't cover this, but there's another file called time series.
Yeah, we were getting there.
They just haven't gotten through. It defines what a time series is. Saw it on one of their screens. They had a 24x7 time series set up. You can have a 24x5 time series set up, so that's just 24 hours a month.
Okay.
We have a time period that's set up 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, except for a 36 period Tuesday night, when the network has to go down for a backup.
Okay.
And you can do
that. Because we actually run cron and crap a bunch of service commands into the Nagios command.
Hey, I'm sorry, say that again.
There's a command file for Nagios. Cat commands in, so I think it's the thing the passive entry uses.
Yeah.
We actually cat service downtime commands into that every night. Run through.
Wow.
That's actually a very good solution. Yeah, we're mainly using the time period command for stuff. Why don't you unload up that file while we're talking about it? But we mainly use the time period command we're monitoring all of our intranet servers as well as our public servers, and we set it not to wake us up. Like you see, we have a time period for awake.
Your normal working hours. I don't want to work
as much. That's the
default distro thing.
Yeah, that's the default alias. We didn't change the alias calls. We never pay attention to that. We basically set it for awake, which is the hours we expect to be awake, or like if a development server goes down, we want to be woke up at 6 a.m. instead of 8 a.m. so that we have a couple hours to fix it before all the developers come in. But
what happens if it goes down at 4 a.m. and it's the field
out? You will get paged at 6 a.m. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But it doesn't hold on to the pages. Like if it goes down at 4 and it comes up at 5 and your time period starts at 6, you don't get paged. It's if it's still down when the time period starts.
All right, this is our host templates, or all of our templates, actually. We have hosts at 3 different locations, and we want to do different things for each host. Example, here at Hosted, we have a 24/7 notification period because we want to know when these go down. This at the office, obviously we only want to get paged when it's awake, as these don't do critical things, or at least nothing critical at 3 in the morning. This is a service template. It's actually kind of difficult to read with the wrapping. Basically, we define a couple of things. Please do notify us by default. Active checks, check period.
And, yeah, you see right there, we're using, again, stuff from the time period definition for check periods and notification periods. So, something that I like is that you can also set a contact notification period. So what we pondered doing, but we just mainly never did because we spent a lot of time just, you know, setting up these dependencies and stuff, and we just kind of have left it alone for a while because, you know, let the sleeping dog lie, don't break anything. But you know, setting the contact of your pager to waking hours for certain hosts, and then setting a contact up for your email set, you get emailed 24/7 if something goes down, or your RSS feed gets bumped if it's during those 24 hours. So that's some pretty neat stuff you can do.
These are all of our hosts. We got a bunch of web servers, mail drones, DB servers. I'm thinking through our example of Ford, which is our basic all-in-one server. We have the host definition up here at the top. It's a, using this template right here. We have a couple of services. So let's once check HTTP, make sure it's still running Apache. Ping, FTP, all kinds of other stuff. Here's an NRPE check, which basically there's just a plugin called check NRPE, and then you give it a command to check. That's good for these files. And as you can see, there's a whole bunch of them.
Yeah, something we did was we actually have some host definitions and services set up for hosts that actually don't exist for us, like our at our office internet service, our public gateway for that office internet service, we have set up as a host definition with a ping service, so we can ping dependencies off of that. So if you know our ISP goes down, that ping will fail and it'll downtime our entire office network or something of that nature. We also do the same thing with some VPN endpoints we have. Since we do all our checks over the VPN, if a VPN fails, we know about it, and we get a page saying, hey, your VPN's down. And so that's another nice trick, too. Anything that's an IP address, you can check with ping and host whether or not there's actually a box on the other end or not.
What else we got?
What you would do then is you would set up a contact group of, say, sysadmin, where the contacts within that would have their time of day set, their notification time period set. Like I was referring before, where if you had three shifts of people, you could put in, you know, either three different contact groups or three different contacts within a contact group and set their notification time periods for three different things. And so that's extremely powerful. Yeah, the time periods are completely independent of each other.
Any question on that? Jeff.
Oh. Hey! We actually, that was the example we used in our presentation. And I'll... Yeah, you go to the service detail. Yeah, you can see right there. It's HTTP, and it says, you know, it's okay. It returns the... Oh, yeah, there you go. Hello. It just... It, Ian, they're older people. They can't... Their mind doesn't work as fast, all right?
In all fairness, everyone is older than Ian.
Yeah, I mean, like the plugins, the check HTTP plugin, you know, it can be a HTTP client. You know, there's actually a plugin that's just called check TCP, which just tries to initiate a connection to a TCP port. So if you're, you know, maybe too lazy to write your own plugin to check to see if the service is actually running, you can use check TCP to just see if you can make a connection to that port at all, and it's a really rudimentary check to make sure a network service is up if a plugin doesn't exist.
For example, if there's a number of different ways the HTTP service fails, 4 or a 500 error, it would fail and page you. Or if you got back a page that said 200 and was 0 bytes, it would also page you. So there's a number of different facets that you get when you know a little bit more about the service as opposed to an arbitrary.
And something that I found out helping my friend Dave set up an Agios server is if it returns a bad error code, if it returns a bad HTTP code, it just throws up a warning instead of a critical. So if it can't connect at all, you would get a critical. If you get like a 403 or a 404, it would throw up a warning.
Can you do virtual hosts and connect to different directions?
You actually, in that case, what I would recommend is setting up a check HTTP with the host name you're specifying being the web address of the virtual host. The problem is the check HTTP plugin doesn't check for content. It just checks to make sure it's there and I get a 4. And it get a, what is it, the OK code.
200.
Is that on Nagios Exchange? If it does, I don't think it ships with Debian package. Or at least I haven't seen it. Yeah, it's crazy. You install the Debian package, you get every single service ever in the planet so that your plugins work. That's Nagios too. You sure? You've got to show me that because that sounds really cool. Yeah, after a meeting. Yes, into that. Well, if you only have one server, it will be kind of difficult for that server to monitor itself. I know that Ian runs it on, how many servers do you have?
Yeah, like 8-10 servers.
Yeah, I mean, it's not very difficult to set up, despite all the confusion we've added to it, making it scalable for us. If you're just using it with one or two servers, I mean, 20, 30 minutes, you could have it set up and working. That's the coolness of being able to script your own notification plugins. That's really neat. Just like, you know, we use the RSS plugin. You can make a plugin do anything. You can make it wall a message across the server. I mean, the notification plugins are almost as simple as the check plugins are. I mean, the RSS plugin we are using is probably less than 20 lines of Perl wrapped around with, like a 10-line bash script wrapped around it. I mean, it's really, really simple. You just feed macros into it as args and just have that notification plugin parse the args and go do something with them. Anyone else before we go to Ian's going to show off his Perl scripts and then I think we're going to wrap up? All right.
Escalation script right here. Basically, it'll take all of your host and service definitions, parse them into a big hash array, and then here's this template here that it spits out and just puts the host and service in here. So you can, you know, easily edit all these when you want it to page, who you want it to page, and so forth. And the service dependency script is pretty much the same, except it reads in this host file right here. Or this host dependencies file, and with that it decides what it needs to depend on what. And all these scripts are up at trilog.olds.org.
Yeah, trilog.olds.org. All of the scripts plus the sample configuration plus the 3 Nagios plugins that we put out there. We actually have a few more custom plugins we wrote, but we didn't provide them simply because of interest. There's nothing that anyone would find interesting about them at all. And some of them are just duplicated where we rather did things our own way than the way Nagios did them. So, does anyone have any questions at this point at all about anything Nagios related? Yes.
I didn't speak about, I didn't mean to convey that, at least. I just said that's what we use. That's what I've used it on, and that's the reason why we're presenting on it that way. It's just a matter of... Trying to get me shot up here. You know, that's something that actually we were going to go into in the sales pitch, is the fact that all of IntelliContact, all of Broadwick is running on servers that are less than $2,000. So we don't have really, well, with the exception of the one we just bought from y'all. But all of our web servers and stuff, I mean, are really not expensive stuff. You know, just some cheaper Dell servers and stuff. It's Raj can tell you a little bit more. Yeah, running this at a colo is much, much better than running it on a slow office network. You get a whole lot less false positive. Nagios does have some special logic in it where it does stagger the checks on purpose. It's actually a setting you can flip on and off, but I don't know necessarily why anyone would want it to be off. But where it staggers it. So, you know, when you first start up Nagios, you know, we have 250 services. It'll spread those out over 5 minutes or however long your check period is so that your server's not just killed with a whole bunch of checks at the very beginning when you first start it up, or every 5 minutes it doesn't drag, things like that. Any other questions? Anyone want us to touch on anything anymore? Going once? Yes.
Do you have to say anything about monitoring queues?
There is a, I know there's one that checks on a postfix mail queue. Like I said before, there's a ton of plugins that does a gazillion things on Nagios Exchange. It's really simplistic, go write your own. I know they do have a check cup plugin. Acknowledgement? Oh.
You don't even know what acknowledgements are.
Yeah, I know what the acknowledgements are. I was thinking in the terms of, like, thanking all the people who helped me write the presentation acknowledgements. Let's actually,
this one right here, did you?
Basically, if you've got a service down, you can click acknowledgement inside your web interface, which basically says, I know about this outage, stop paging me, don't escalate. Yeah.
Have a 2x4 reserve if you don't acknowledge it. I'm one people that would have to. And you acknowledge me, I'm a problem. And I don't acknowledge it. Walk it away. And
if you tell them
Well, if you created different users, it shows it. With, like, if you're just using the one user, it'll show the one user posted the acknowledgement.
Yes. It is wise to create multiple users. What the man in the corner says.
Yeah. Yeah, more than like two people logging in Nagios.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so that's good. I'm glad you mentioned that because I meant to hit it. My brain's kind of scattered when, like I said, we lost a good chunk of this presentation. Well, I didn't tell y'all, but we lost a good chunk of this presentation about 30 minutes before we left to come up here. So some of this was thrown back together a little bit more. We don't want to show you how many times our servers have gone down. What are you talking about?
A little bit late.
Just we did have scheduled maintenance last night, so
yeah.
Scheduled.
See, this report is really useful. It 0% up, 0% down, 0% unreachable.
When you become an experienced system in like me, you don't see red on the graphs anymore.
Exactly. As long as you buy services, talk about how you become an experienced with
that. All right, so thanks for bringing that up. We were just going to show up, but like I said before, we don't really grab much use from that. All right. Anyone else? Going one? You're not allowed to ask questions. Next. No.
On that note, it's worth showing what day
we can pull up Ganglia.
Where's Ganglia at?
Wallace.intellicontact.com/ganglia. Yeah, I absolutely love Ganglia.
So the nice thing about Ganglia is that it's all a single packet and a cluster of servers communicate via multicast. And the point is that you get all of this basically just all in one packet, setting one line
as a file. Load up a specific server and let them see all the metrics I'll do. Load up one of our database servers called, we have the custom MySQL metrics set up.
Just 1A does.
Oh, only 1A? You see, you've got all sorts of crazy information here. You know, the load graphed over time and stuff like this. And actually, the server that had this on it crashed about 4 months, 4 to 5 months ago, hardware failure, and we have data all the way back to then. And it was even going back farther than that before it crashed. So it's very nice. If you use it long enough, you could even look at yearly graphs and really awesome things like that. The thing I find so helpful about this is determining, you know, load is an iffy metric for measuring a server, but if you've got a web server, you can almost look at your network traffic and determine how much web traffic's coming in or, you know, memory usage, things like that. It's very nice. So, any? All right. Well, for sitting through and listening to me talk for, and Ian for like an hour and a half, which, you know, make sure to appreciate the good people who work at Broadwick. We have a printer to give away. Now, there's a catch. The first person who can tell me from the marketing presentation the four tabs in the IntelliContact 4.0 interface gets the printer.
That goes down to whoever's fastest with Firefox.
Kevin is excluded. Well, David was the only one to give away the printer, so, you know.
Printer works in Linux.
We checked.
Yeah.
And I also wonder, why is it he gave the presentation on a Windows laptop for the Linux group?
Flame him.
Because I like dual head that works all the time.
Ooh, I got one just hit the floor.
Linux servers all day, Ed. Got to have a laptop that works all the time. So. Never, but okay. So, apparently... apparently no one remembers from the beginning of the presentation the four tabs of IntelliContact, which is sad. Any other bright ideas?
Pick a better question.
Pick a what?
Pick a better question.
Well, you pick a good question then.
Pick a good question.
I'm just amazed at like that nobody with a laptop wants a free printer. Woo! Yay! You've got to say IntelliContact is awesome. What? with more feelings. There you go. Yay.
If nothing else, then, I'd like to thank everyone for coming out. If you have a membership card that you haven't picked up, come on up.